Do I need to bring mine so you can record?
Want to try getting it on the telephone and see what happens.
Hey, Your Eminence?
Yes.
I'm gonna be here for a while, but I gotta do an oil change tonight.
Well, you can do that after class. You know what a flashlight is? Later. That thing is wet. I'm gonna try to do it on this show and see what happens.
If we
may do that, if it comes down to it.
Okay.
Very good. I appreciate it, too. All right. We have a quite interesting lesson this week. I will not be encroaching on His Eminence's territory of the Torah specifically, although I will make some inference. You guys understand that word? On how it will relate in some respect to our Nazarene code still. So this should be, I pray, a most interesting lesson. And so what we will do is we will start, as we usually do, with Gibberet Sheba on the front row.
Mine is on page 47. About middle of the page, the big old paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Talks about God's purpose in creation was to bestow was the bestowal of His goodness upon His creation. God alone is not God alone is the personification of true perfection. I won't read the whole thing, but that paragraph right there was just phenomenal.
Yeah, and of course you realize that if you look at footnote 50, that this is
from the way of God.
From Derech Hashem, the way of God,
mm-hmm.
And it's the same author that of the book that you're studying with His Eminence. It's same author, not same book. But of course, this shows his understanding. He lays out in this book, Derech Hashem, the way of God. He lays things out so systematically and perfectly that if you had any question about purpose or the way that God's plan will unfold, that book is, I have just a pocket edition, but there's a normal sized vision, of course, and it is quite a beautiful work. I have cited out of that book so many times that is so awesome. Yeah, it is. It's probably one of my favorite, probably the favorite of Luzzatto, and I would say my favorite book, period. It just captures so wonderfully the way, we ask questions, but to try to find the answer, you try to find the answer and you find the answer. The way he's gone about it is so systematic that it's wonderful, wonderful. Very good. I like that verse a whole lot too. Gibberet Gevorah.
Well, that was exactly what I had marked out because the way of Torah has been, the way of God has been just a phenomenal book for me.
Good.
Have it on my bookstand in the living room, and when I'm wanting something to inspire and to read real quick, that's what I pick up.
Yeah, you can always find wonderful.
Right. I can just open it anywhere, and I can find something that will just minister to me. So
it's as if it leaps off the page, huh?
Yeah, it is. And sometimes, especially when I don't know what I need, it's like I've tried to read the Torah, I've tried to read something specific, but when I read that, it just ministers to me. So I mark that. I mean, there was a lot in here. I enjoyed on page 46, too, where it talked about to you it is given to know the sa'od of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed that part and understanding what that means. So.
Very good, very good. Good, good. We're going to be talking about all of that this evening. Gibra Hadassah, Mother?
Yeah, mine's on about 44, where I just never put it together before that God raised up would not be corrupted, like in Yeshua.
Right.
And it just, I just never even thought of it before.
Yeah, very good. Very, very good. Yeah, and one of the things that I could say about this is people have a false image of a Messiah, and then they think that because we say that certain tenets of their faith are incorrect, they think that we're diminishing Messiah. But that is absolutely the reverse. Actually, to give the power of Messiah, as it were, to a human being, it strips away all of our excuses. Because mm-hmm. now, if he had this ability, do you have the same ability? Yes. He was a man, so am I. So it's quite... Shalom, Brother Nathan. knowing this is quite interesting, quite interesting, and quite revealing. So it should be a wonderful thing to experience. Very good, very good. Your Honor, Don Sergio.
Chairman, I think kind of sums it up a lot for me is on page 45.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the underlying thought is mita kaneda mita.
Very good.
If a man accustoms himself to small measures of truth, he only receives small measures. First Sephet said in 5:6, be humbled under the mighty hand of God so that he will elevate you in the appropriate season. Pull those all together, kind of, you know, that's where we need to be.
Okay, I'll give you the irony of the evening. Today is
Thursday.
We're talking about the 14th going into
14th,
the 15th. Okay, we're concluding the 14th
right.
And going into the 15th. Now, if you look at that paragraph at the very bottom on the left-hand corner, what number do you see?
14.
14.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Yad HaZakah, so this evening. This evening.
How it alludes to 5.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 1 + 4 = 5, and it's like, oh, duh. You know, first we said, mighty hand, that one hand has 5 fingers. That was the first thing before I started reading the notes down below. And so, and it's like, oh.
Very
so,
good.
So you should go on bottom of that page, going to the next page.
Very good, Your Honor. I can relate to that myself. Okay, I want to try to weave these pieces of the puzzle together so that we all can perhaps see the Nazarene Codicil here in a way that is quite revealing. So I'm going to work out primarily out of the Tosefta and the Peshat of Chamshul and Chacham Sefet, and I'm not going to at length try to deal with the remez, because I'm going to make a remez of sorts out of the Peshat and the Tosefta. Okay, so now just read it, and then we'll try to unravel things as we go. Said, and he, Yeshua, said to them, is a lamp, light, a candlestick, etc., coming in to be put under a bushel or a measure basket or under a bed? Now, thinking here of not a candle, but a lamp, okay? Now, of course, when we're talking about a lamp in antiquity, We're talking usually about a small oil lamp, and it has a place in the center. It's somewhat oblonged or even almost triangular in shape, with basically a more rounded...
looks like a genie pot.
Like a little genie thing. And so what happens is they pour oil in the middle, and in the front, at the very front, there's a flame that becomes the light. Now, so we're not talking about a candle that's like some of the candles that we have in our mind today. We have a long foot-tall candle that's about a half inch around, etc. We're not talking about that. We're talking about some smaller... lamp that can easily be covered without, you know, any possibility of burning down the house. Or, depending on how high the bed is, you could slide it underneath the bed. Now, His Eminence would stop at this point and ask you, why would you do such a thing?
No, I was going to ask you, why would you do something like that?
Look it now.
Protection?
Said, it's a lamp coming into and put under a bushel. Or under a bed. Okay, so what we have here is that whatever that the light is illuminating is hidden by the either shoving it under the bed or putting a bushel over the top of it.
So is it alluding to the time that we hid our Judaism because we couldn't allow that Torah light to shine because of protection to protect us?
Our lives are the light.
We'll talk very much about those things in a minute, but here it's very literal at this particular point.
Right, okay?
In Peshat. Well, now, we can draw remes or allegorical inferences from it, and we will, but it's very interesting here. We don't live in this world quite so much anymore, and the world is that, you know, when a husband and wife go to bed, you know, today it's just close the door. In antiquity, many of you have seen that there's not really any doors, maybe curtains, etc. So, you know, there's a lamp usually left on in the middle of the night so that you can still see and not stumble over everything that's in the house. And so when the husband and wife decide that it's time for intimacy, they slide it under a bed or put a bushel basket over it or something of that nature, okay? Which is very interesting that you should have these intimations, these ideas of having some sort of an intimacy in the idea of the light. So this is the idea here. You put it the lamp underneath the bed. And then, of course, we'll go and draw out allegory from this in a minute. So for there is nothing hidden which will not be exposed, nor is kept secret. Nothing is kept secret that will not come to light. Now, obviously, you know, you can talk about this in many different aspects, but the aspect that's being spoken of here is generally read in the negative. And so you're saying, you know, if you do something that is wrong, eventually you're going to get caught at it or it's going to be exposed. And this is not truly the true context of this piece of text. What it's trying to say is, for example, that the laws of God, even though they seem hidden, they're hidden to the world or they're hidden to the Gentiles who don't know God. But those who seek to know and understand them, they will be revealed to them. So nothing that's hidden will be, you know, remain hidden. It will be exposed because we're going to do what? Because we're going to study to try to receive and understand the secrets, okay? Now, a Peshat, it's very difficult to say in Peshat, secret, because secret in Peshat has the idea of you not being able to know something that somebody else knows. But this is truly not the true context of the idea of sa'od or secret, because of the, as I've said several times, that the secret is actually what transpires in your mind. And so when the teacher teaches or the rabbi teaches or you know, illumines the verse, then all of a sudden a light goes on in your mind And it's kind of like the I could have had a V8 type thing. You get to the place that it's quite revealed to you. Now, the interesting thing is the teacher, as I've said in the past, will try to lead you down the path so that you get the idea or you get the secret. But no matter how hard he tries, he may cause you to see something. But what's working in your own mind also influences how you receive the secret, okay? So the teacher never does, as hard as he may try, and as much secret as you might receive, as it were, out of a class, he never knows what secret
exactly
you really...
Because it's
in your mind. It's hidden in you, and so he really, really doesn't know. He thinks he knows, and the reason he thinks he knows is because he has the secret in him. But it's... The secret revolves around what? Our whole lifestyle. Every experience that we have in some way influences our reception of this idea that does come to light. Now, I want to stop right here for 1 second, because in Matthew... This same idea and this same text will come out to where that it begins to speak about the city that is seated on a hill and it cannot be hidden. The city that is on the hill that is Yeshua is speaking about is Tzfat. Okay? And if you've ever been to Israel and you've been, for example, around the Galilee, the Galilee, then you'll look and you'll see Tzfat is that city that's on the hill, and it will be a place that that's evident from everywhere around. And so I say that because His Eminence and myself, I agree with His Eminence. When we were in... Israel, 2010, we had a conversation in the Garden of Gethsemane with Gila, and she was talking about the difference or the different ways of understanding the word Notzar, which is taken, and usually they try to make Yeshua from Nazareth, which is very problematic, archaeologically speaking, and even literature, trying to find a place, Nazareth, as a place of his possible growing up, etc. It's more logical when you understand Notzrim has an association with Tzfat, and Yeshua being the branch, or those are the branches, okay? So this is a little bit of an allusion to, in my mind, to Tzfat, which is that city that cannot be hidden. So in other words, if he's saying there's a city that cannot be hidden, you understand then there's a truth, a Saotic truth that cannot be hidden, which obviously you should relate directly to Messiah, right? And the many things that he represents, okay? If any man has ears to hear, let him hear. And that's very interesting because this phrase is the phrase, the catchphrase for the Talmud, and which means the Gemara and the Mishnah and the Gemara together. The Mishnah being studied by and then elucidated in the Gemara, which is Peshat and Remez together. So the catchphrase in the Talmud is come and hear or come and listen, etc. So here we have that statement, and it basically then alluding to something more allegorical, okay? And he said unto them, take care of what you hear, with what measure you use, it will be measured to you. And to you, hear more will be given. For to the one that has, to him will be given, and he that does not have, even what he has will be taken away. So it seems like that there is some almost injustice in this, that, you know, if you don't have it, guess what? We'll just, you know, even what you don't have, we'll take that away too. Or what we'll do is conceal it to the place of you not being able to receive it. Okay, you understand? So he's not taking away something that you don't have, but you'll have, for example, you may have something committed to memory, a verse, let's say. And you think that, you know something about that verse, but what he does is he hides the true meaning of it, and he also you don't even have what you think you have, okay? Now let me do Tosefta, because then I want to hopefully jump in and try to unravel some things here. It said, no one, after lighting a lamp, puts it in a secret place, nor does he place it under a bushel, measuring basket, but places it on the menorah or the lampstand. He said that those who come in may see the light. And the light of the body is the eye. Okay, so we start to see here an association. It's a little bit beyond Peshat, right? You see this? Because he's talking about now the eye, what the eye sees. If we start to talk about what the eye sees, we need to be encroach almost on Sa'od. And why do I say that? What's the cliche we have about a picture?
1,000 words.
A picture's worth 1,000 words, okay? So in other words, you capture a frame, a still frame with the camera, and then someone who's, let's say you were at, the Festival of Sukkot. And somebody was a speaker there. And, you know, there was dancing and all these things. And they take a picture of some things that are happening. And so you want to show this picture to your friends. And so you can take a half an hour just telling them what's in the picture. Okay? So this is why the eye is used. Because when something makes an impression on the eye, millions of signals are being sent back and forth between the eye and the brain. The eye is feeding the brain a certain amount of information, and then the brain sends information to the eye. In other words, you know, look at that, and then, oh, look at that, because that's connected to this, etc. Okay? So the eye becomes quite saotic, and at minimum here, allegorical with many of the things it sees. Therefore, when your eye is whole, obviously speaking to someone who has a mature eye. Because if we translate this word whole,
entire, every, or all.
Yeah, back into Hebrew, even Mishnaic Hebrew will come with the word shalem, which is the root word for shalom. So when your eye is whole, means that, number one, you have a good eye, and number two, that the things that you're being able to see are things, now taking it to allegory, the things that you're able to see, you see with clarity, okay? Your entire body is also full of light. Said, but when it is vain, your body is full of darkness. It doesn't take much to understand the idea of that which is good and that which is evil with regards to that. Now, we had a little bit of a phenomena in the general area that two of the dollar stores closer to McKenzie and Henry have been broken into. And the intelligence of the men who broke into two of them, now being robbed, understood that the building's metal. All you have to do to get inside the building is take a screw gun, take the screws out of the metal, throw the metal aside, walk through the wall.
Oh my gosh.
Okay? There's alarms on the doors. Unfortunately, not on the walls, or even not even motion sensors in the building, which should be, right? Because no matter what, how you enter, etc. Okay? So these men's eyes are dark, right? Because they're looking at taking something that does not belong to them. Thought that was quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Therefore, pay careful attention to and remain full of light, the Torah, so that there is no darkness in you. And if therefore your whole body is full of light, having any darkness, not having any darkness, it will be completely full of light. And if you notice that we have bracketed in Torah, in vanity, etc. As it is when the lamp with its light gives light to you. Now, before I go on to that, you should understand here now, it's quite simple to basically start to unravel the allegory, right? Pay careful attention and remain full of Torah. Mm-hmm. Okay? This is your light. This is your guidance. And we'll talk more in just a minute about what we call the Or HaGanus, or the primordial light. But if your life is wrapped around Torah, and it doesn't necessarily mean that every second of the day that you're studying the Bible. Because there are, I'm sure, many things that you do. And Jewish people generally do what? They generally say, as many blessings as they can. They go to the bathroom and say a blessing. They get up in the morning, they say a blessing, etc. Have a piece of fruit, have a blessing, etc. So the idea is to remain full of light. And this is the intention. It's not just to say, okay, that the only people that are full of light are the people that sit and study Torah 24/7. And that's in our world, it's nearly impossible to do such. And I would say, even in circles where it would seem that, you know, they're coming closer to it, you can't escape the fact that there are daily duties and necessities that have to be accomplished. You cannot abandon life only to study Torah. You'll starve to death.
Torah says if man who doesn't work doesn't eat. So you got to work.
Yeah, this is said by Hakam Shaul, I think, in Thessalonians. Okay, which is very true, right? You don't work, you don't eat. So in other words, you know, you can you can be in a society where, you know, you don't bake the bread, but somebody else will bake the bread. But guess what? You know, after a while, if you're in a community, you'll bake the bread. You know what I'm saying? You'll share back and forth with one another. But let's just, you know, take an individual by himself. Guess what? If he doesn't get out and plant the crop, he won't have bread.
Right.
And consequently, he won't have a lifestyle where he can study the Torah like he wants to. And no one, after lighting a lamp, covers it with a clay jar or puts it under a bed, but puts it on a menorah or lampstand, so that those who come in can see the light. For nothing is secret that will not become evident, and nothing hidden that will not become known. And here I'm saying, bracketed in, speaking of the idea of the ones who are inside of the circle. Okay? This works really well for us understanding Yeshua's circle. And us associating or trying to keep ourselves within that circle, okay? But being inside the circle costs a whole lot more than being on the outside of the circle. Let's say it like that. Which is also the oral Torah, the Masorah, and come to light. Therefore, consider how and listen for whoever has, to him more will be given, even more, and whoever does not have even what he thinks that he has will be taken from him.
I realized something this week.
Okay.
In studying the way of Torah, the inferences that you make are what's in parentheses. So when you know what the language is, you know what its context is, you know where it came from, and
right,
whether it's a Hebraism or whether it's Greek, and what the type of Greek it is, that's how you know what kind of inference to make.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So by, you know, just reading in those little places, now for those that don't understand, let's just look at a piece of this for a minute. Look at the Peshat. It says, and he, bracketed in Yeshua, right?
Right.
So it's inferring that Yeshua is the one speaking.
Right.
Said to them, he said, the lamp is coming in, but to put under a bushel. Now this is definition here. It's a measuring basket.
Right.
Okay? So it gives you more. So each place that you see, either it bracketed in and or not bracketed, but in non-bold letters,
right,
is to clarify the text. Now, this is what the King James does generally well,
where they add
a word is added in italics, and when you read that word in italics, you understand that it's not there in the original text or in the manuscripts, etc. So, you know, something's being inferred. Now, let me say with this, you can do the same for what I translate, the way I work this. Check it out. I don't care. It doesn't bother me. But this is also one thing that you should do with the King James Version of the Bible, because sometimes it infers things. It gives an inference, but it's an invalid inference. Okay? For example, when he blessed God for the bread, it said he blessed it, inferring that he blessed the bread.
Right.
But he did not bless the bread. He said the bracha, he blessed God. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that inference is incorrect. You see
right.
what how to
right.
solve some of that. Okay?
That's kind of what's hit me this week in looking at those things. That's why you have to be very careful about the translation. That's why you have to understand. You know, that's why you guys are teaching us what you're teaching us, so that we can understand when there's been an invalid inference, when there's been a valid inference.
Sure. And the thing, very, very important for you, is to don't just sit down and read it like you're reading the Reader's Digest. Unfortunately, people read it this way, and that's the way we were taught, basically, to read it like you're just reading a story. Or whatever. You don't read it like a story. There is a message in the text that Hashem and the authors, etc., are trying to convey to the people that read or listen to the text. So stop and look at the text and ask questions of the text. So who's talking? What are they talking about? What are they inferring? What is the Torah portion? What is the prophetic section? What is the psalm? How does this particular piece of the Nazarene Codicil, in this particular case, or in our discussion, how does it relate to the Torah portion, etc., etc.? And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute, okay? Now, let's see if I can do this quick. page 3. He sent, and it's very well, his eminence is bracketed in the Targum, he apostolized, okay? So he's an authorized agent. Now this is very important to what we're going to say this evening, but he sent him ahead, he sent Judah ahead of him to Yosef, and to direct him to Goshen, and he came to the land of Goshen. Now, if you study the commentaries on this, you will note that what is inferred by the commentators and Rashi and some that are otherwise, you will find that he sent him there, and his eminence makes a note on page 8. The completely yellowed in section, but I will start with the top of the page, literally ahead of him. He sent him, Yehuda, ahead of him before he would arrive. The Agadic interpretation is that there should be teaching to establish for him a house of study from which teaching would emanate. And so now his eminence shows something's quite interesting here from the Hakam, his eminence. The Hebrew word here literally is, and he sent Yehuda et. So it puts it et, and ve'et implies a feminine something in connection with Yehuda. This thus alluding to the Beit Midrash, a feminine word in Hebrew. that Yehuda came, Yehuda was commanded to establish his father Yaakov for his father or by his father Yaakov, and further corroborating explains Rashi and the Midrash Tanhuma, and you can also see Acts 10:36 for similar construction. Okay, so what was Yehuda sent to do?
To go establish a Beit Midrash.
Okay.
His house of study.
So he was intended to go and to start a house of study. Now let's ask the million-dollar question, going back to the Nazarene Codicil. How on earth does that relate, or does the Nazarene Codicil allude to or infer that what it's talking about is the same as what is in the Torah section?
Bringing the Torah and light, bringing light to, it takes Torah to bring light, and a Beit Midrash is to study Torah.
Okay, so the Beit Midrash, the house of study, is to study Torah, but now we could play a little bit of a word game here, but we'll do it with allegory. You can do a couple of things, allegory, with the inference out of the Torah Seder. Number one, and its connection to the Nazarene Codicil. Number one, you would see the light as the Torah. Okay? So you could easily draw that the light is being associated with the Torah. But you can also say that the Beit Midrash is the light. And the process of, you have
is that
a secret?
Why the feminine and the marital inference in Mark?
Absolutely, we're going to try to get there.
Okay, sorry.
No, it's wonderful, wonderful. Okay, we're going to try to get there. Okay, because they have a very, very cryptic piece of text that is used in the Haggadah that I want to disseminate. Okay, so the Beit Midrash is the light, or the house of study is the light. So that's not problematic for us, is it? Because that's where we... It's where we learn Torah and the Torah being light, but it's also back to the idea of, you know, Ford or whoever it was had a better idea. I don't remember who it was. Somebody had a better idea and then the light turns on. Or the V8, the V8 analogy here doesn't work really well.
It's also the light that you have to, it shines on you to see how well you're doing or how well you're not doing. I mean, it
shines out of you, shines on you, shines through you, etc. Okay, so you see the two inferences. Number one, that the light coming in is the Torah being received. Okay? Because there it said, the lamp coming in is to be put under a bushel. Now, if we play this a little bit further and say that you got the light and you go around and everybody sees the light, but you don't really want to talk about the light, so you keep the light hidden. How do we resolve that issue? Very carefully. Just little words and little inferences. Those are the best. Why are they the best? Because they're like baiting the hook. And someone wants to know something. For example, they're always asking about our lifestyle, why we do this, why we don't do this, what you eat, what you don't eat. And of course, they always have themselves armed with certain scriptures, and unfortunately, most of the time, those are taken out of context. All right. So, we see the light coming in is being in the Beit Midrash and receiving the Torah by the teacher, okay? So, there's a multiple ways of seeing this. Number one, the Torah is the light. Number two, the lesson is the light. Number three, the teacher is the light. And number four, you are the light. And number five, you become the teacher and you give the light. And number six, and... Huh? I do. My little shorthand scribbling them all over the paper. Okay, does that, have we made the connection to the Nazarene codicil with the Torah and it's understood so far? Now, page 45, where we'll talk a bit about the commentary. Adon Suriel spoke of mita keneged mita, measure for measure. Now, understanding this, let's suppose that we don't even have to suppose. We can just talk about reality. Many of us have to work to earn a living. Unfortunately. And so that really, really bugs me because I want to spend more time studying the Torah, right? Okay, but stop and think about this. You know, you'd say that this person, for example, whoever you would say, that they have more time and they can study the Torah more than you can. Okay, but it's mita keneged mita, so that does not mean that this person necessarily gets a greater reward than you do, because that means that when you can study the Torah, when you can study Scripture, that you make the most of it.
It's the quality, not the quantity.
And absolutely. So what you do is you make the most of your Torah study, and thus mita keneged mita, inferring then that you receive according to what you put in. So it doesn't mean that you receive less than the other person because you have given everything that you can to study the Torah when you can. And if at all possible, we try to train ourselves to think in a way that what happens to us is that we say, whenever your mind is not occupied with business at hand, let's say, that, you know, prayerfully you can try as best as you can to turn your mind toward Scriptures, Torah study, etc., okay? So, mita keneged mita in that particular meaning does not specifically mean that you have, you know, you don't get as much as the next guy because you do have to work, okay? And here I say, in other words, the next paragraph under the indented section, it says, in other words, the man who devotes only a little time to study a Torah only receives little information from it. Now, that can be true if that is the intent of the heart. He just gets a little. And it doesn't matter if he studied Torah for all day long. The intent of the heart, the attitude of the heart, is how you will be repaid in all of these things. Okay? Because what can go on here is the idea that you can go to greater awarenesses or deeper awarenesses if you will devote yourself to a spiritual lifestyle, if we can. Now, one of the things in the second paragraph down, not the indented line, but we have been talking about and has been the situation in Mordecai or Mark that is the governance of God. Now, this is what leads us to what Gibret Sheba and Gibret Gibora were speaking about, and about the community of that Luzzatto speaks of, okay? Let's go down to the line under Hacham Safek, Peter 5 and 6, 1 Peter 5 and 6. This is quite prophetic. I will include that verse. This verse is quite prophetic. And His Eminence says, and I absolutely agree with him, that there would be a work eventually. I accept that he had prophecy. He was a prophet, okay? He was of the school of Hillel. And all of the students of Hillel merited the gift of prophecy. So not only was he the student of Yeshua, he was in the school of Hillel in that thinking. And so each one of the students that fit into the house of Hillel merited having the gift of prophecy. So Chacham Safed is saying what? He's prophesying basically that one day we will accept and understand a particular work to be the governance of God, the guidance in that kingdom, however you want to say this, but it would be called Yad HaZakah. And of course, now the major legal treatise for us, especially as Sephardim, is to study the Mishneh Torah. And believe me, it's well worth the study because it illuminates so much and erases so many questions about how we conduct life. Not in a legalistic way. It is not intended to be legal. It is intended to be understood in such a way as to be guiding, to guide us in how we conduct our lives. The great question that every Jew has is, what do I do with this? So if you have a instance in your life, the thing that you're going to do is, well, what do I do with this? And so, for example, just one simple idea is that women in the kitchen know if you happen to spill a little milk inside of the beef stew, it does, depending on the quantity of milk, et cetera, that goes into it, that it will or it won't destroy it. And then from there, we have Sevarah as to whether we should eat it or not. Okay? So those are legitimate questions. You know, if it says not to do milk and meat, we want to understand, you know, what does that mean? What are the inferences of that statement? Okay? Now, Chacham Safed, through his amanuensis, that's like his secretary, translator, student, scribe, all that, amanuensis, Mordecai builds up the kingdom governance of God in five similes. Said the passage cited from one Safed is directly associated with the revealing of the kingdom of God or God's governance, or the governance of God. So we're speaking here specifically about the governance of God, okay, how God would govern, and we'll go in a moment to the idea of the perfected community, but nonetheless, this is very important to us. Those who are willing to be humbled under the authority of God, governance of the Batidin and the Hakamim, are destined for elevation and greater awareness of the mysteries of that authority. Now, what is interesting is the people who reject rabbinic authority have no idea what they're doing. They're separating themselves from a mechanism that can be the greatest liberty they've ever experienced. Generally, Chachamim have a two-edged sword. So you say, Rabbi, what's the halacha on this? And so the rabbi gives you the halacha, and then he says, that's halacha. And then if he's a good hakan, what he'll say is, now let me tell you how to get around it. Okay? So he's trying not to put some burden on you that you cannot bear, and that is not the context of the words that are used in Acts. But he's not to put this on you. He's telling you, here, look it. But now here's the chesed. Here's the loving kindness of God in this situation. There are different things that you can do to accomplish something without succumbing to legalism.
That's what the 160th rule for milk is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what if it was 161?
If you didn't have anything else to eat, you eat it.
Oh, you see, it doesn't have to be. You don't. Okay, let me measure exactly how much this is, and measure exactly how much that is.
You really wouldn't have a clue whether it was 160th or not, anyway.
Exactly, unless you say, "Oh, look, I had a whole cup of milk, and now I got a pot that's this big." There's where legalism.
If you got meat out, what do you got the milk out for anyway?
Good point. Good point.
You milk,
yeah, but you know, you got the baby cat that needs to be baby.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Excuse me. Now, let's go on down to Governance Bate Dean. For elevation of greater awareness of the mysteries of that authority. We can just stay here on this sentence for the rest of class, but we will not. I'm on page 45. Second paragraph up from the bottom. Okay. You want me to move to another page? Well, I will in a minute, but I've got the... Now, you understand that... Got some questions to ask? Okay, I would, but you understand what we're supposed to do. Midrash means to thresh.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so, you know, if you're threshing wheat, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get all the kernels of grain off of that thing, and you'll beat
all
that... Yeah, exactly. You're going to try to beat that thing until you get everything out of it. That's the idea of Midrash. That's the idea of Midrash when we come to an understanding of the Midrash, for example, of Matthew and trying to understand the kingdom, which is Midrash is always very closely associated. That's why this everything that's in here is closely associated with Midrash. Okay, so the governance of God and deep awareness of the mysteries for the sake of building an authentic theocratic society. Only with this infrastructure for society can we return to Eden, the garden of delight, or the garden of pleasure. Now, you should understand this in a way, perhaps, that you have not understood it in the past, this particular statement or this idea. When you join into a community, and the community is a community that is working together toward specific goals, it doesn't have to be, you know, we're planning to take the Torah to the entire world. It doesn't have to be anything that significant or serious. But when you have a community and there's a community gathering, when people understand how to live in the community appropriately, for example, here we are this evening as a community, even those of us gathered by the internet, but we're as a community, and what are we doing? We're studying the Torah. Okay, so what is our greatest delight? Okay, being in the community and the community working toward perfecting itself through Torah study. So for us, there are times when we approach Gan Eden, because how we approach Gan Eden is as a community to sit and study the Torah together. Is this not our delight? Is this not our Eden in certain respects? Because if we have good teachers, they teach us things that spark our imagination and fire our imagination and generate questions that burn inside of us, and we want to have an understanding of those things. And so it's not just a dry, okay, turn to page 3 and read the following paragraph. Okay? We want to be able to understand the depths of what is taught, and it becomes for us an Eden. So Eden is not, in that case, a place.
It's a frame of mind.
A state or frame of mind.
Frame of mind or even a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so the lifestyle that we're trying to accomplish and produce is?
Study Torah.
Studying Torah?
Within the perfected community.
Within the perfected community. We want the community to be perfected, so we put our two cents into the community, so to speak, whether that's cooking Sabbath meal or attending class or whatever, that's a piece of it. But also, one of the things that is very, very important to us should be our relationship with Hashem. And
each other
and Hashem. But the idea of connecting with God on that level is what? We find ourselves connecting, and that connection, shalom, brings us peace with God. So we should be finding that peace in our lives, okay? So now, do you want to ask your question and tell me what paragraph?
Well, it's just, we want a perfected community, and how do you, it's not like Christianity, how do you handle things that kind of disrupt, ruffle your feathers? How do you handle things that kind of rub you the wrong way?
Sure. One of the things we have to understand, and Dr. Aleshev, and I've said this many times and talked about it many times, the bodybuilder can only build muscle when the muscle failed. Okay, so let's say your goal is to be able to lift 300 pounds. Well, you can't just go pick up 300 pounds. That's not going to happen. So what do you got to do? You've got to start with a weight,
a 1 pound weight
of whatever is comparable to what you can or cannot lift. When I was in high school, we had weightlifting in our physical education classes, etc. I weighed 107 pounds and could bench press 190 pounds. But I didn't start out with 190 pounds to be able to bench that much or to lift that much weight. I had to start off with something that was much smaller than that. But what happens is you push until you can push no more, and then you're just about to drop the barbell on your neck and your spotters put it on the rack, okay? So Dr. Aleshev and I said, you burn the muscle out, so to speak. And then when the muscle rebuilds itself, it's stronger than it was prior to that. And then you can go farther and farther. So what I'm saying to answer the question is that the only way that we can grow to greater depth spiritually is to have opposition. If we don't have the opposition, we will not grow.
How do you resolve it without this?
Without conflict?
Yeah. Without offense.
Offending someone?
I am very adamant about not offending.
Sure. And you should be quite
however
well.
However, others are not.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. It requires being much like a mother or father, a true mother and father who love their children. And, you know, when the child is trying to run out in the road, the parent does what? It corrects the child, but not because the child did something wrong in a way of doing something evil. It was innocent in its actions. And many times people are very innocent in their actions. But what I'm saying is that you have to be motherly or fatherly to be in the community, conducting yourself as a mother and father in the community. But obviously, the greatest thing will be chesed. One of the things I do, and it probably drives people crazy, the community crazy, is that if there's a problem, and it's going to look like somebody somebody's going to be singled out because they did something wrong. What I want to do as the rabbi of the congregation, do something wrong intentionally so that the focus is not on another person. Okay? On one occasion, somebody forgot to bring their tallit or something. And usually I have an extra tallit, but someone forgot their tallit. And so what did I do?
Nobody wore the tallit.
That Sabbath, nobody wore the tallit because, you know, it's not about pointing out this person's failure or that person's failure. It's like, okay, you know, do it with chesed. And one thing let me say, most of us here in this room and most of you attending class here this evening are people who are very committed to study. I mean, you know, that's what you want. Even if you're not in this class or you're even not in His Eminence's classes, you by yourself are going to be devoted to Torah study or you know, scriptural study. There's no question about it. You're going to do it. But not everybody can keep up with everybody. Some people cannot do what other people can do. Now, I'll tell you quite frank, and His Eminence will tell you the same thing. The two of us speaking together, we know that, you know, the amount of work that we used to produce over the last 3 or 4 years, 5 years, whatever, we cannot produce the same amount. Does not mean we cannot produce the same quality. It means we can't do the same amount. And so, you know, when a person is working a job of 50, 60, 70 hours a week, whatever, you cannot expect this person to be able to turn out the quality of study that you have. So that means a measure of chesed, right? And so how do you help the situation? You don't enforce their need to study the Torah. What you do is you disseminate Torah to them in a way that is giving them a measure of light. For example, you know, something that you really find fascinating, you can share with them, and they didn't spend as many hours in study as you do, but they are getting the quality that you have put into it by receiving what you gave to them. Does that make sense? So
it's our responsibility in building the community.
Absolutely.
We have to build each other up. Those who don't have time to study, those who do have to build the others up.
Absolutely. That is our absolute job. Okay? So, did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting that on page 46 to go with that. Mm-hmm. In the middle where it's highlighted, to you it is given to know the Sa'od of the kingdom. Okay? If you understand the Sa'od of the kingdom, then what do? You help others in the community understand the Sa'od of the kingdom. Because one thing that works the best is not pressure. The thing that works the best is bait. So find your bait. Find the place that people are, let's say, semi-awed about things that you know and things that you experience and et cetera. And then share that with them, and then you will find you'll find that things are happening with people that are around you and you didn't even realize, and all of a sudden they'll have been a part of the community and never thought about it. Okay? To you it is given to know the Sa'od of the kingdom. Okay? Now let's go down to Avot, Mishnah Avot 2:4. Hillel says, do not walk out or abandon the community. Very, very important. Because it does what? Understanding the community, the way, one of the best ways to understand the community was understanding what it was like to travel through the wilderness. What happened if you What happened in those days, walking through the wilderness, what happened when you gossiped?
You got separated. You ended up with
Sarat or leprosy, okay? So then what happens to you? You can't be a part of the community, okay? You're outside the camp. In other words, now you're outside the jurisdiction and protection of Hashem. Remember when Marion wants to say something ugly about her brother? What happens to her? And she's outside of the camp for a while, okay? At least 7 days. Okay, so you see that here, one of the great, great difficulties is being outside the umbrella of God's protection. Because what should have happened to all of them, not just the rebellious, but what should happen to all of the children of Israel in the wilderness?
They should have been eaten by whatever was out there.
They should have all been consumed by the desert. Because the desert has one intent. Absolutely. So you see that the power of the desert or being in the world can be nullified by being a part of the community and accepting the governance of God, by accepting God's governance and his theocratic rule. What do you think the 613 mitzvot are about? It's not about placing hardships on people. It's about
dying to self, living for joy.
Because in the community, you do things, but you're not doing the things for yourself. You're doing them for the sake of the community. Okay? And you're doing them because you want to help other people enjoy being in the community, enjoy the benefits of being in the community. One of the benefits of being in this particular community is having the number of women that we have who are excellent, excellent cooks. And so it's interesting because we have a very eclectic taste. We like a lot of different types of foods. And it seems like somehow there's a magic when all the women get together and everything just works out wonderfully.
Especially with the jalapeno peppers.
Especially with the jalapeno peppers and Rabbi's quinoa salad. See, so, there's paradise in the community. Okay, so don't walk out on the community. This is a very, very important idea because it means that a person is outside of the protection of the community and literally on the outside of God's protection. And that's when the enemy begins to take shots at you with license, okay? And do not have confidence in yourself until the day you die, and do not judge your fellow until you are in his place. And do not say anything which cannot be heard, for in the end it will be heard. And do not say, when I have time to study, said, for you'll never have time. Second, Hillel said, a crude person will never be sin-fearing or a God-fearer or God-fearing, nor an Amharetz, a common person. Now, this common person is just like, people that don't care about the Torah. They're not even associated with wanting to understand the Torah.
They're either agnostic or
sometimes. Yeah, or just that they're preoccupied with the fact that they have to work for a living and then that's everything that they're about in life. Nor will a bashful person learn, nor will a short tempered person teach. Okay?
One more on the next page.
And nor will any one too busy in business get wise. Very well. Okay, go down to. Huh?
I like that last one.
Yeah. Interesting. When Hillel's brother saw how wise he was in the Torah and that he was only a businessman, of course, he had no heart for Torah whatsoever, but he wanted the reward. So he told his brother, he said, I'll tell you what, there's precedent for this in the Bible. He said, what I'll do is I'll pay for you to study the Torah, and then I'll get half of the reward for you doing the Torah study when we come into the Olam Haba. Hillel said, no. But now there is intent, this intent in the...
In the 12 tribes.
The tribe of Zebulun.
He is a supporter.
Uh-huh. In other words, the one tribe did work for the other one so that they could sit and study Torah. But it was an intentional agreement from the beginning, not one of these like, oh, I get to share in your reward because, or, you know, have some conniving plan to be able to do so. Okay. Now let's go down to the paragraph in question, in page 47. The purpose of creation, etc. Now, I want to be careful about this because I don't want people to think that I have any subversive intent. But about two-thirds of the way through, middle of the paragraph, it'll start, through cleaving to God, each creature, you see that?
Yeah.
Has the ability to progress to the highest degree of perfection possible. Now, the sixth commandment, if you study from the Rambam, is pleading to God. He says in that elucidation of the commandment, he says that cleaving to God means cleaving to the rabbis. I will say that is absolutely important to further your education, and we're still talking in the idea here of Torah education, the Beit Midrash, and light, etc., connecting all those things together. So cleaving to the rabbis, or cleaving specifically to sages, etc., is very important. Why? Because through them, we have ideas that we would have never entertained. It's not any type of having control over people. It's because the rabbi's greatest desire is not to sit on a Beit Din. That is not his desire at all. His desire is to be able to teach the Torah and cause his students to enjoy receiving the Torah and learning about the Torah, etc. Okay? So that's his true desire. I have no desire to try to make some judgment and make it impose it on people, and it be some form of hardship. Absolutely none. Nor does His Eminence or His Eminence. Neither of us have that idea. His Eminence, in all of the halakha that He has made rulings for the community. Dr. Elisheva and I can attest to the fact that 99% of them, 100% of them have always been full of chesed. He's trying to do something very positive and be very, very gracious for the community. Okay? So by clinging, now I'm going down to, we want to the highest degree of perfection possible. Because both flawless and deficiency exist in our world, God has established a means for His creatures to avoid deficiency and acquire perfection. By clinging to the elements of perfection, we are able to attain a level of perfection that emulates God's perfection. This is exactly what God wants. He wants us to emulate Him. By the way, you want an honest definition of spirituality? True definition of being spiritual? Allowing God to be Himself through you. That is true spirituality. Through the acquisition of excellence, we are able to resemble our Creator. Okay? Therefore, the social order of the Oral Torah has one basic pursuit. We know that it ultimately revolves around one basic principle, namely the assembling of a perfected community fit to exist in an eternal state of intimacy with God. Now, skip the piece in the middle because you can read that for yourself. Consequently, we deduce that the oral Torah that God daily breathed to Adam and Chava was for the sake of creating a perfected community. This was Adam's job. Okay? What? Be fruitful and multiply. In other words, as we say, there is a law of reproduction. The law, principle, however you want to say it, of reproduction means you cannot reproduce something that you are not. Okay? You can only reproduce yourself. Okay? So you can reproduce yourself, but you cannot reproduce what you are not. Okay? So hopefully that's clear enough. It said, herein the temporal world gives way to the eternal, ever-coming world through the personification of the Masorah. I will stop right here, but I want you to think about this statement, because what I'm trying to get, what I want you to see out of this statement is, rather than this, quote, Christian idea of flying through the sky and et cetera, what's going to happen is that if, what will happen in some basic way that we don't realize it, and I'm not trying to talk about Christian eschatology in any way, shape, or form. I absolutely loathe it. And so what I'm saying to you is, it's kind of like a situation where that someone talked about Enoch and Hanukkah in Enoch in the scriptures, and the analogy given was that, you know, it said Enoch walked with God, and then, of course, he was not. So as an explanation, they say, well, you know, Enoch was walking with God one day, and then, you know, God said, look, Enoch, you know, we're closer to my house than we are to you. Why don't you just come home with me? Okay? So I say that because what we need to realize is that one of these days we're going to raise our head and we're going to realize that we are in the days of Messiah. Is it going to come with calamities and blah, blah, blah? There will be these things, but it does not mean that, you know, the Jewish people were in Goshen, in the land of Goshen, and they did what? They raised their heads one day, and the persecution had stopped. Why? All hell is breaking loose for the Egyptians. But what were the Jewish people doing at that time?
Going about their business.
Going about business. They were not subjected to any of the plagues, with exception of some minor issues. Okay? So, we need to come to realization that, yeah, the world can be collapsing around us, but that doesn't worry us. It's not something to be afraid of. We belong to Hashem. You know, here you got somebody that's, you know, living in the land, and you know, God wants to bring punishment to the world. And what does he do? He has loving kindness with a man called Noah, associated with the word nechama, or peace, or comfort. And so God comes and he uses a man called Comfort to comfort the remaining people who will become the continuance of society or continuance of the world. So don't think that it has to be a world that, you know, magically somebody wiggles their nose or waves a wand or whatever to make this wonderful world. The wonderful world we can experience in and of ourselves, and we can experience Eden in our own self in the place of our Torah study. And I would say to you this, I would say, stop and think about your Torah study, and in the classes that you take, be at that place to say, you know, this is my place of reception, where I receive aspects of the emanation of Gan Eden. You see what I'm saying? So come to the class with an attitude of entering Gan Eden and knowing that you're going to go through the gate of Machpelah, and you leave outside everything. This is most appropriate, especially on the process of Shabbat and the process of the Haggadah, where we enter into the sacred place with the wine and with the candles. Okay? Now I want to just conclude with this. Today is the 14th, now the 15th of thank you, Abov. In His Eminence's document, The Feast, which I talked about last week, on page 22, I think it is. I think I wrote it's page 22. Yes, it's page 22. I didn't print the document with numbers. I just printed it straight out. So here's what it says for the 14th of Av. And of course we know we're going to the 15th. It said Moshe goes up to Sinai a second time to plead for the mercy after the golden calf. Okay? Now, 1 second. You have this, the new Torah study. You can turn to page 41. Middle of the page. Shabbat 17a. Okay. Let me read this one more time. Okay, I'm going to read the feast document, the 14th of Av. So Moshe goes up on Har Sinai and a second time to plead for the mercy after the golden calf. Okay, he gives a reference of Shemot, Exodus 32, 30 through 35, and Babylonian Talmud Ta'anit 28b. Here I'm citing a passage. This is a piece of the Nazarene code still, Shabbat 17a, and another. It said, on one vintages, grapes, and vats, etc., to manufacture wine, Shammai maintains. It is made fit to become unclean, while Hillel ruled it is not made fit. He said, Hillel to Shammai, why must one vintage grapes impurity yet not gather all its impurity? So he has an argument to make here. He said, if you provoke me, he replied, he said, I will decrease the uncleanness in the case of the olive gathering as well, or two. A sword was planted in the baked midrash, and it was proclaimed, he who would enter, let him enter, but he who would depart, let him not. Let him not depart. And on that day, Hillel sat submissive before Shammai like one of his disciples. And it was grievous to Israel as the day when the golden calf was made. Now, Shammai and Hillel enacted this measure, but would not accept it from one another. But their disciples came and enacted it, and it was accepted from them. So you see here now, an association, two associations with the idea of the sin of the golden calf. One has to do with many problems that we'll not get into at this moment, but the other has to deal with the Beit Midrash. Okay? Question.
On that specific vein, the Beit Midrash being where they made this decision?
It was a more a Beit Din than a Midrash, although it was a Beit Midrash.
So
the Sanhedrin always was a Beit Midrash.
Right, so how did the students...
In other words...
I'm trying to tell you, I know Beit Din makes that final decision, but according to that statement, just in the cursory reading.
In other words, that Shammai enacted those 18 edicts, okay? But it doesn't matter what he says. Makes no difference what he said. He could have come up with 500 edicts. It makes no difference until the disciple decides to keep it or not keep it.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay?
Yeah, because it didn't, just that curse.
Because the Beit Din can, they can be, Beit Din can make a ruling and say, for the whole congregation of Israel, said you can't eat turkey in the month of November.
But most of the time, though, they go, when it's something like that, it's got to be something that is possible for the entire congregation to
this
keep.
This is what I'm trying
notified.
To get to. Okay, this is what I'm trying to get to. Listen. The Beit Din says, you cannot eat turkey in the month of November. It might go over in Europe, and it might go over somewhere else, but it's not going to happen in the United States.
Right.
Right? And so the people are going to say to the sages, good law, carry it somewhere else.
So, in other words, because the disciples accepted what Shammai said, and they carried it out, that's why it became established as edicts and laws.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense.
If the community doesn't accept the law, though, they don't.
It becomes invalid.
It becomes invalid, yeah.
Even though it is a law.
Yeah.
Right.
Even though it is a law, if they don't keep it, they
don't. There's a percentage, though. There's a percentage of, I don't remember, it's two-thirds. There's got to be at least two-thirds of the community that you're capable of keeping.